Thanks for listening to the Stimulate Run podcast. If you like what you hear, remember to subscribe, leave a rating and a review. If you would like to get in touch or have future guest suggestions, please make contact via email or slide into DMs on any of the social channels. Here's your host, Erwin, with this episode's guest.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Stimulate Run podcast. So I've been meaning to get in touch with today's guest for quite a while. He has a bit of a link to the podcast indirectly. I'm not sure if he knows by his knowledge, but his name has been mentioned by one particular regular on the podcast, which is Wayne, for years now. So it's been great for him to say yes to jumping on. And I'm interested to unpack not only his running journey, but he also is an official course measurer as well. So I think it'll be good for a lot of listeners to get some insight into that world and how it works. And it's not just done off your Garmin Connect and predicting courses, and courses are long, courses are short, that kind of thing. So he has his own quite decorated running background. So he's got a 100K of 6 hours, 39 and 26 seconds. And Don, you can correct me on after all of these. Comrades of 542 and some change, which is a gold medal. He's won 6 foot track on multiple occasions. He's got a marathon PB of 220 and some change. And he's the current Sydney and Gold Coast Marathon course measurer and probably a few others along the way as well. So without any delay, welcome to the Stimulate Run podcast, Don Wallace.
Yeah, thanks very much. Only one thing I need to correct you on is I only won 6 foot track once. That was in 91. I think I had the record there for about 14 or 15 years. And I think I didn't go back and run it for about 14 or 15 years. I think when I did go back and run it in I think the best I got was about a third in 2009. But another one of my favorite races after Comrades, I suppose. The 6 foot track, it's quite a challenging thing, and I think people who get in it really, it's a race they really love.
I suppose before we get going on, I suppose, who you are and a bit of your history, it is a race you hear about, probably now being overshadowed a little bit by UTA and that kind of race. Is it still as popular as it ever was, or is it just more for even locals?
It's hugely popular in New South Wales. So it's most probably more Sydney based runners will run it because it's in the Blue Mountains, it's close to there. It's still a run. Which I'll say is different to what these UTA trail runs and things like that, which become sort of ultra runs, and people running around with a whole lot of gear on their backs and carrying sticks or whatever. It's not like that. It's a trail run, which is just a run that marathoners do. You don't need to carry a water bottle or anything. You just run it, and there's some aid stations along the way, and you don't need any support or anything like that. So it's one of those races. I think I did in 91, there was about 200 people there. You paid your $20 the night before or something, and I think when I started going back to it in the around about 2005, 2006, and that stage, it became one of these races that they can only have 800 because of the limits of the track, the physical track itself. And they open up entries, and it's it's less than a day. It's most probably less than half an hour nowadays. The entries are full, and the wait lists are huge. And I suppose it is a little bit niche because they're limited. You're running on a very narrow track in places, and also they need it's in an area where access is hard. So you need the they support the bushfire service in the area, and they need access with four-wheel drives to get to certain points along the track to support people. So yeah, that's the whole thing that limits it. And I suppose because it's limited, then the people that do it again and again, and it's hard then for newcomers to get in, or harder. Yeah.
And it's quite impacted by conditions too, am I right? Like, has there been a couple of years where conditions have impacted it?
Yeah. You cross the Cox's River at about 15 Ks, and if there's heavy rain fall in late summer, the Cox's River is dammed further up there for a power station, and if it's flooding, then they've had to cancel it. Yeah, a couple of times with flooding, it's been cancelled, but not that many in its history. I think two or three times, or maybe two times in its history, has been cancelled. Yeah, and also possibly bushfires can affect it, but it's usually it's pretty late in the season for bushfires in that area.
Well, we digress a bit there, but tell us a bit about yourself. Like, where did, I suppose, primarily we are here to talk about running, so you can kind of tie running into your answer, but where your sporting background, like, were you into a range of sports growing up, or was it primarily you found running and that's where you went?
I just grew up as a normal kid, and you know, I grew up in Western New South Wales and places like that. You played a bit of rugby league, and I played a bit of rugby union, and my father played those games, I played a bit of that all through high school, and even when I went to university, I still played rugby union in the University of New South Wales in Sydney. So, but you know, I got to the point in that where I sort of thought, well, I wasn't really that talented a rugby league or rugby union player, and being about, well, I'm still about the same weight as I was when I left school, which is about, you know, just over 60 kilos, 60. Three, 2 or 3 kilos, you're not big enough to play those sort of games. And the other thing, you know, it took me a while to figure it out, but I just had no speed at all. And you need, it's not a game where you can, well, you can do a little bit without some speed, but you still need a bit of speed and talent in that sort of direction. So I think when I finished university, I thought, I'm never going to get anywhere playing this game. And I was playing at a level with guys that weren't working anywhere near as hard as I was at training and stuff like that. So I thought, I'll do something else. And I always kept fit with a bit of running and that. And as I said, I was going to university in Sydney. So I do a bit of running around, just keep fit. And I got keen enough. I think my last year at high school, I did a bit of running, and I did some track for the school that I went to, and that was the first bit of it was a new I changed high schools for just for the last year, and that was the first time I did a bit of running at school, and I enjoyed that, and did a fun run in the local town, which was the Bathurst Edgel Jog, which was a big race in those days, and I thought, oh, this is great. So when I was going to university, it was obviously in Sydney, so I'd run the City to Surf and a local uni run, and go back up to Bathurst and do the Bathurst Edgel Jog, and that was the sort of extent of my running while I was at uni. And I was reasonable at it, you know. I wasn't at the back of the pack, you know. I just, but I wasn't, you know, I trained for a little bit just before those races, and that was about it. But when I finished university, I sort of thought, I'm not going to be a rugby union or rugby league player. You know, I might go into, you know, I decided I'd do a few triathlons, and they were just kicking off. This is in 1983 was the first one I did, the Nepean Triathlon, which is at near Penrith in New South Wales. And because I loved cycling and I loved running, I couldn't swim for nuts, but I thought I'd have a go at that. But after a while, I figured out, yeah, I really couldn't swim for nuts, and I gave it away because I found that, you know, it wasn't too hard to pick up a bit of fitness in cycling and running. You're way behind the eight ball if you couldn't swim in triathlon. So, yeah, so that got me into running. And, early I was back in actually Bathurst in New South Wales and just running around a bit there, and there's some guys I started training with doing a long run, and they were training for the Canberra Marathon, which in 1984 was the Olympic trials. So I don't know if people remember it, but it was a huge race. It was probably the last time we actually had an Olympic trials in the marathon. Lisa Martin won the women's, of course, and went to LA. And Di Castella didn't have to run because he'd already been selected. But Grenville Wood, South Australian guy, won the men's and also went to LA. So yeah, and at that stage, I was thinking 80s, you know, running a marathon's sort of a big thing. You know, there was plenty of media attention. So, I ran the Canberra Marathon. I ran 2:52, and I thought, oh well, that's pretty reasonable. You know, this might be something I'll stick at. And you know, yeah, after that's what I decided to. So I ended up moving up to Brisbane. And I found some work up here and started running around the scenes. And I ran a couple of more marathons at just under 2:40. And so I was sort of reasonably happy with that. By that stage, I joined an athletics club and was training a bit. And getting good race experience cross country was pretty strong here in Brisbane at the time. And there was plenty of fun runs and road races. And of course the Gold Coast Marathon and that, and actually and there was a couple other marathons in Brisbane. There was a Moreton Bay Marathon and later a Brisbane Marathon. So there was plenty of opportunities to run, and you know, I was racing against guys running a bit quicker, and you know, it just spurred me on to have a bit of a crack at that as well. So by I think it was 1986. I was, no, 1986 or 7, 1987. Yeah, 1987. I entered the Moreton Bay Marathon, and there's the few guys going around that were running under 2:30, and you know, it sort of got to that stage where I thought, well, I want to get to this sort of that level of those guys that were getting in the state team to represent Queensland in the marathon, and I was able to, and I changed my you asked me about training programs and things like that, and at that point I changed my training. So prior to that, I'd run basically what everyone was doing at the time, which was, you know, your Di Castella sort of type training of you know, mixing up your speed and the endurance and stuff. And I didn't find it worked for me. I'd run a 2:39, and then the next race I ran 2:38, and it was a good period between them. So I sort of thought, well, that wasn't much of an improvement, 1 minute, you know. So I'd read a lot of Arthur Lydiard books by Lydiard and that, and I really liked what he was saying, and not only that, I could read his books, go away, do what he was saying, and he said, well, if you do this will be the result, and he was always right. You know, if you do some good aerobic work, you build a good, strong aerobic conditioning. Yeah, you know, you do a bit of strength and hill work. Yeah, that'll improve your results. And so I went from doing that, from running 2:38 to running just under 2:30. And the following year at the Gold Coast, I ran 2:23. So in, you know, so that gave me a lot of belief in his systems. You know, to go from being a, you know, around about 3:40 a K per in the marathon, around the 2:40 mark, to being in the low 2:20s. I mean, I think that would give anyone a bit of belief.
Yeah, I was going to ask people who influenced your running, and I predicted you were going to mention Lydia and just his methods and just that over time. Did you kind of have to say to yourself too, though, that it was going to take time, and kind of just go, okay, well, let's just put in the work for time and time and time.
Correct.
And hopefully
it's an apprenticeship, you know. You so we're talking from 84 to, it took me 3 years to get to sub 2:30, and then by 88, you know, I'm round about as good as I'm going to get. But the thing also with Lydiard and Barry McGee, who won the bronze medal Lydiard trained Barry McGee. He won the bronze medal at the Rome Olympics. And I had a chance to meet with both Arthur and Barry at various times in Auckland, and Arthur over here in Queensland. He often came over to visit Dave Powers, who was a top class Australian runner that lived at Noosa. Dave Powers was around in the 50s, and that went to Com Games and things like that. And he's good mates. Arthur was good mates with him, and so Arthur had come over, and so I had a couple of chances of catching up with him. But yeah, they also sort of said, well, if you do the work and do the work that they were talking about, you know, you'll get those results quicker. If somebody's doing, say, half the mileage, say 50 mile or 50, you know, 80 k's a week, you know, he's going to take a lot longer to get the same results as a guy that's going to be doing 140, 150, 160 k's a week, you know. But the other thing is, and I still believe very strongly in the work. And a lot of people say to me, "Oh, I can't run that many kilometres or miles a week." And I'm going, "Well, yeah, that might be true, but that's because you're doing it wrong, you know." and that's because they're trying to run fast or run speed work when they're trying to build aerobic conditioning, you know. Aerobic conditioning is going out there and running at a nice steady state that you can maintain for the whole distance, you know, and as you get fitter and fitter, your pace will improve, you know. You don't but as soon as you start mixing up, you know, trying to run fast and doing all sorts of strange track sessions and things in with that, then yeah, it most probably won't work. And Lydia never advocated that, you know, and still didn't, you know. There's a specific period, and that's the other key thing I liked about his training, the specification. You'd run the mileage, we'd do strengthened work, which was through hills, and that's the one we'd start to introduce a bit of speed and form and picking up a bit of speed, and then just then sharpening up for racing. And by doing it that way, you know, I always found that I was in very good shape for all the races that I, you know, ever entered, you know. Very rarely did I, I have a look back over my career, and there's very few races where I think I failed to perform well, you know. The only times, maybe in a few marathons, where I was a bit below par was, you know, because you've been fairly greedy and, you know, try to back up and run another one a bit too soon after the previous one. So, yeah. And the same with comrades and things like that. I mean, you've got to be patient. You know, you've got to be prepared to always prepared to just run one marathon a year and make it a good one. You know, as when I started running comrades, I was prepared to just focus on that's what I'm doing. I'm, you know, nothing else matters. You know, yes, I'll do some lead up cross country and shorter races, but I'm not going to go and run a race just because I can maybe win it or pick up a little bit of money or something like that. If it's not, if it would have any effect on what the end goal of running comrades, you know. Sorry.
Was it?
Sorry, Erwin. You're breaking up a bit. I might turn my camera off, but yeah.
That's probably a lot better. Yeah.
Yeah, that's better. Yep.
Yeah, I'll just. When did you have your aha moment? You know, that it clicked and that moment where you realized that things were changing and you had the jump. You know, you mentioned you went 239, 238, but then obviously you had a big jump to 220. Did it happen that quickly, like that bigger jump, or how did that all play out and you had this reality that you're not half bad at this thing?
I think in 86 I ran the Moreton Bay Marathon, which was on in about May late May here in Queensland, so still reasonable conditions, and I ran at that 238 at that year. And then in 87, I sort of thought that's what spurred me on. It's, you know, I thought improving a minute for all the training I had put in for that race over the previous year hadn't been much. So that spurred me on to sort of, you know, really take into account the Lydiard training system and adopt that and put it into my training. And yeah, that made the difference between a 2:38 and a sub 2:30. And then once I had that, the following year, 87, so 88, I decided to run the Gold Coast. And the 2:23:55 was the next one, but that really came out of the fact that I couldn't make the state team with 2:29, you know, 2:29:50 something it was. And they selected six guys to, you know, it was the national titles were held at the Gold Coast for a few years here. They selected six guys, and I couldn't make the state team with a 2:29, and I think most other years. But and the guys in front of me, they're running 2:25, 2:26. So I thought, well, I've got to run two, you know, I've got to run better than that, you know. And okay, why I couldn't make the state team, because you had guys like Pat Carroll, who'd run 2:10, or if he hadn't, he ran 2:10 that year. You know, Laurie Adams was had run sub 2:20 a couple of times. His best was 2:16. He was based on the Gold Coast. If you don't know of Laurie, he was a bit older. Pat's about the same age as me. Then there was some other guys running around. Rob Crisado, who was a come from Rocky, but lived down here in Brisbane, and he'd run about a 2:26, I think, at the time. And Ian Kent was around the 2:25, 2:26. Kenty was a guy that, you know, ran four or five marathons a year and, you know, just churned them out and got faster and faster. And then there was another fellow, I think, made the team that was just running super well. He hadn't run a marathon, but I think he'd run a very fast half. And so they gave him a slot in the team. And I think the last place guy in the team had run a 2:27 or something like that. So, you know, I lined up there in 88 at the Gold Coast and thought, well, I've just got to go out hard and, you know, hang on. And, you know, and I was able to do that. And in fact, I was third Queenslander on the day, you know. So I was pretty pleased with that, and I beat these guys that had previously been in front of me, and then that gave me the belief to sort of to be able to race at a pretty good level there. That validated all that training, that or the Lydiard training that I'd done, you know. And there's quite a lot of good runners, or not quite a lot, there's a fair few good runners around the 80s here in Queensland, but you know, I was quite happy just working like that and doing things that way, and it just worked well for me.
You obviously then found the liking for going long and the ultra distance. So you did World 100K a couple of times. How did that come about? Where, you know, did you just kind of say, oh, that looks interesting, I'll kind of give it a crack, or was it something that was always kind of in the back of your mind that you wanted to attempt?
Yeah, well, the late 80s there, I just focused on the marathon. It was the Gold Coast, and yeah, you know, I got down to 2:20:59 in the race in 1990. I suppose I could have maybe focused a bit more on that. The following year in 90 was, I'll give you an idea of things at the time, I suppose, because I think things are getting back to being very competitive in the men's marathon in Australia. But at that time, they were really competitive. In 89, I think Brad Camp ran 2:10 at the Gold Coast, you know. That just was crazy at the time. And, you know, he was like 22-year-old, and, you know, guys like, you know, Gerard Barrett, who was a Queenslander, you know, he'd won the Moscow Olympic trials as about a 21-year-old, you know. So guys were getting in and running marathons and running good marathons. Andy Lloyd, you know, they were all running good marathons in their early 20s, you know. So there was plenty of good marathon runners around, and quite a few guys running under 2:20. So I was fifth in the 1990 race. When I turned up there in 91, I ran 2:23:01. So I was 2 minutes slower, I was 23rd. You know, so Well, you could do all right at the marathon, being a low 220 guy, or maybe have a crack at breaking 220. There's still plenty of guys in front of you with far more talent that were always going to run better. So, I think in 92, I had a bit of a flat spell. It's probably 91 to through to 92, where a lot of hard training and a lot of hard physical. I was doing a lot of hard physical work at the time. I was working mowing lawns and that. And here in summer in Queensland, that's pretty solid stuff. So I think that had a big drain on my body. So in 92, I was feeling a bit flat. I didn't run that well at the Gold Coast, and I'd run a few trail races. So there was another trail race down in Sydney in the Royal National Park, which is just to the south of Sydney, and it started off it being the first year I ran it was a 77K, and they decided, oh, well, let's make it 50 miles or 80.5 or 6, whatever Ks it is. And so they changed it to that. And I'd fly down and run it because, you'd just be looking around for, well, where's a race where I can make a few dollars? And someone would come up, putting up $1,000. So I thought, oh, yeah, fly down. And if I had a win, that was $1,000 in my pocket. And, I think an airfare down and back was about $200. So, I did that. I won it three times, 91, 99, sorry, in 1990, 91 and 92. And when I was at the 92 race, the guy that came second in it was Trevor Jacobs, who was a current Australian record holder for 100Ks on the road. And I had never met Trevor before. But after the race, he was telling me, oh, well, there's a 100K race going to be run in New Zealand. The Australasian 100K Championship is going to be run in New Zealand. Anyway, I thought, oh, yeah, well, maybe I'll go and do that, for something different. And so I decided, yeah, I'll have a crack at that. And at the time, there was a fellow who organized, I don't know if you've heard of the Glasshouse Mountain Races here in Queensland. And the guy that organized it was a fellow called Ian Javes. And Ian had lent me an Ultra Trail magazine or something, a US magazine anyway. And it talked about 100K race in the World Championships, which were in Duluth in 1990, which were won by a Frenchman called Roland Villemot. Anyway, I looked his time. I can't remember what it was. It was around 6:30 something. And second place was a Kiwi guy called Russell Prince, which I didn't take too much notice of. But third place I did take notice of was a bloke called Janos Kuros. And I'm not sure if you listeners, but if they know anything about ultra running, they certainly would know who Janos Kuros was. And Kuros had run 6:43 for 100Ks. And I thought, oh, what's 6:43 for 100Ks? And, got out the calculator and I figured out, well, 6 hours, that's 360 minutes, and another 40. That's is 400 minutes. So 400 minutes divided by 100, that's 4 minutes a K. So I thought, well, if Cross can run 6:43, I should be able to run 6:40, and I could run 4 minute Ks all day, I thought. So so that was my attitude, and I went over there, and geez, surprisingly, I did that. I was quite fabulous. Just run, I suppose most probably by about 25 Ks. I was just by myself, but just kept clocking out 4 minute Ks. And a little bit under there, a bit, I think. And it wasn't until about the last year, 10 or 15, that it was to slow down a little bit. And just managed to break 6:40. So that became the Australian record. And so after that, there was opportunity to go to the World Champs in 94, and some other opportunities. So that's most probably in 93, I went back to New Zealand, and 94, I went back and did that same race. In 93, I went to the World Champs, which were in Holland. I didn't run well there. I got to about 70 Ks, and I had strained my hamstring, and I thought, well, might be best to pack it in there. In 94, I went to the World 100 Ks at Lake Saroma in Japan. But there was a lot happening before all of that. So, which leads us into comrades, I suppose. So, but that's how I got to running sort of comrades, because I'd run a few hundred Ks. Now, when I was in New Zealand in 92, there was actually two people at that race of importance. The first one was Arthur Lydiard, so I got another chance to catch up with, or most probably the first chance I had really to catch up with Arthur and have a good chat with him. And then the other fellow that was at that race was a guy called Malcolm Campbell. And Malcolm was the president of the International Ultra Running Association. He was an Englishman, elderly chap, but he'd been around for quite some time and done a fair bit of ultra running, and he was the international president. And in 1993, he actually contacted me and said, oh, was I interested in coming over? He was trying to put together a team to run at the Comrades Marathon. But it was very short notice, and I'd already arranged to do other races. I'd set myself to run a marathon and this and that. And yeah, he was doing this very late in the piece, very rushed before the Comrades race. So that I didn't go, and he ended up having a few runners there, but no one of much note. I think it's just a couple of English guys and things like that. But in 94, he got back to me later on in 93 and said, 94, we're going to put the, give a really good international team and go over there. And this was the, I mean, well, in 93, the race was open to internationals. So if people are aware of the Comrades Marathon, they would know that there was a sporting ban on South Africa due to the apartheid regime for quite some time, from the 70s right through the 80s. And until they had free elections there, I think in 93 sometime, that sporting ban was lifted. So in 94, because Malcolm knew me, and he wanted to get a good representation of people from around the world, I suppose, and I was the Australasian champion. I was one of the runners on his list, and the others were two Russians, Konstantin Santoloff, and Santoloff was the world 100K champion in 92 and 93, and a guy that just was banging out 620 100Ks like there was no tomorrow. He was a 216 marathoner, and yeah, just a phenomenal runner in those early 90s. The other Russian was just the number two guy that was going around at the time. Don't see much of him after the race in 94 again. The other fellow, that there were six of us in the team. There was two Frenchmen, Roland Villemot again. Now Roland was the French national 100K champion. He had a 6:30 100K time. He was in his late 40s at the time, still running very, very well. And as I say, won the world 100K champs in 1990. And the other guy was a fellow called Charlie Doll, who was a German. And Charlie had won the down run in 93. So Charlie had turned up in Africa and in South Africa, won the down run, and was poo hard a bit. The South Africans had this tendency of going, oh, these, well, before the 94 race, I turned up there in South Africa with these half a dozen guys, and we were going to race. And the local media, the South African Broadcasting Corporation, the commentators on there just going, oh, no, these international guys aren't gonna, they're not gonna be any show at Comrades. These guys don't know how to run Comrades. It's probably the worst thing you could ever say, because following that, well, Alberto Salazar, who they and Salazar, world marathon record holder, they poo-hard him as well, after Salazar won it in 94, the next four uprun were all won by Russians, and international
Yeah,
guys just
that
dominated, comrades just dominated.
that whole period of time was very interesting because I suppose that just come off, apartheid, everything else, but the locals had this real stranglehold. You had the Fordyce, the Besters, and the Paul Johns, Mateus, and then it was
Mateus.
almost like the Raiders came in, and the Russians came hard, but also particularly for the uprun, like they really had the stranglehold. Like for some weird reason, some of the internationals, the Russians particularly, would dominate the uprun and then
I
wouldn't
don't,
be
I,
that long.
yeah, yeah, Erwin, I don't think it's, I don't think there's a strange reason. I'll give you my reason for it. Okay. I generally believe, and we're seeing something very different now in comrades, and it's, we're seeing the black runners dominate it now, which is good. But my belief, is that the black runners and the black runners back in the 80s and 90s weren't well supported, as they most probably are now, you know, and the white runners were getting all the support. So the Besters and the Mikkel Johns and things like that, they were getting good support in that. But you know, and actually in the 94 race, Theo Raffieri came third, and, you know, and he was quite vocal, you know, he got out there and said, I said to him later, you know, when I met him a couple of years later, I said, you know, yeah, that was good of you to, you know, stand up and just say, you know, they weren't being looked after as well as, you know, other guys that most probably would, you know, might make the top 20 or something like that, most probably would have been looked after, if they were white guys, would have been looked after better than the Theo Raffieris, you know. But I just believe that the local black runners and that, they're just too lean a body mass, you know. So they just don't have the fuel to the Russians and that, you know, had, you know, can and burn up. And the same with myself. I thought I'm going to be much better at the up run because we're much stronger. You know, we're you know, you get stronger, thicker legs, you know, and these meaner guys they're going to just burn up all their fuel and just not have quite the strength to go the you know, go hard at it for the up run. And you know, that had been the case right through, you know, the 80s there, you know, and the 90s. And you know, most probably, yes, in the 90s there was very few black runners that you know, Theo Raffieri, well, you look at Theo, he was a pretty solid sort of guy. But the lighter guys were great on the down run because, you know, yeah, you know, these guys had heaps of speed and things like that, but they'd burn up their fuel a bit too, you know, they couldn't be as conservative with their fuel on the up run, and they just didn't have the muscle strength of the Russians and that, you know.
Well, that's, you kind of look at those Russians that dominated, like the Grishans and Volvans, and they were, you know, I don't know, TV ads a bit, but they were tall and very solid on the down line. He couldn't break 7 hours.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that was his record. He just couldn't, he would pretty much be struggling to get a silver.
Yeah. Who's this? Who was that? Grishan?
Grishan, yeah.
Oh, Grishan. Yeah. Grishan was very solid sort of guy. Yeah. He was even, you know, you know how solid Nick Bester was, but he was even solider than Nick. Kortov, a different kettle of fish. He was very small and you know, big, you know, fast leg turnover. He was a very short, small guy, but Grishan was quite big. And Alexander Volgan, he was very tall, not as solid, but quite a tall guy. You know, much probably taller than Sean Mikkel John, but I always think Volgan was the most unluckiest guy to ever run comrades. If you look at his times,
well, and the fact that he comes second, did you know he was an Olympic race walker? I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Oh, well, he was a world junior. He was a world junior 20K race champion.
Yeah, and he famously cramped about 2.5K from the finish in the lead. Deck of cards came tumbling down one year. On a down run. But back to like your history of it, did you just pitch up there, or, you know, I say this on every podcast with a comrade runner and go, like, what type of research did you do? And I know internet wouldn't have been a thing, but you know, like, what type of backstory did you chase to find out?
Yeah. So have you got a South African background? Because your name.
Yeah, I was born there. So my dad had 10 comrades. So
You haven't got the accent and you haven't got the name. But
no, I did all my schooling overseas. But it was interesting because you mentioned Salazar. And one of my greatest comrades' memories is actually being on course the day Salazar won.
Yeah, so
And
was I.
we were all, yeah, well, everybody was waiting for him to blow up
To blow up.
because,
Yeah, it was
yeah.
incredible. Yeah. His last 10 Ks was 44 minutes. But he had just this massive lead, you know. It was just crazy because, well, they all, you know, it was all on Bester, I suppose. They started looking, you know, they had their sights on Santoloff because Bester had raced Santoloff in 93 at the World 100 Ks. Okay, so World 100 Ks in Holland in 93, Bester was there with Matthys, and I'm just trying to think who else was in the South African team then. There was a couple of the blacks. Might have been Conrad, anyway. But they were there, and they raced Santoloff over 100 k's in Winschoten in Holland. And in that race, I can't remember the placings, but of course Santoloff won it. His last 10 k's was 36 minutes.
Yeah, right.
know, so he just ran away from it. So they knew Santoloff was a big danger, you know. And they waited and sat back a bit, and Salazar just went off with Durky Moorman, because and Moorman was there to run 25 k's hard because he's just a TV runner, a hill runner, and a couple of you know TV runners went out hard, and Salazar, you know, just because of his background in marathon racing, you just keep up the front somewhere, you know. And just ended up being so far in front and went through halfway in, you know, this amazing time that, you know, was right up there with the fastest time anyone went through halfway. And these guys were all hanging back in this big bus with Bester and Santoloff, and Santoloff, Santoloff ended up pulling out of the race. He'd probably sometime before that, he'd had some injury to his ankle, and he never got it right after that. Most probably from all the 100K racings, he was doing 5 or 6 a year, you know, back to back. And then so Best to sort of push hard to try to catch Alberto, but it never happened. And it was a really hot day too, you know. It's really quite a hot comrades that one. And no, I didn't just rock up there. So Malcolm Campbell, who's the president of the IAU, invited me. So the Comrades Association paid for air tickets, and I arrived in Johannesburg, and as soon as I arrived there, we were looked after, you know. They met us at the airport. They had a room there for us. The guy that was looking after me and the other guys, so there was a fellow whose his wife worked for the Comrades Association, fellow from Pietermaritzburg called Robbie Meyer, and he sort of became my instant manager in South Africa. And Robbie looked after us in the hotel, and there was, say, the two Russians, a couple of French guys, another French guy, Denny Gack, was the current French 100K champion, Villemot. Charlie Doll was pretty well looked after by himself, or by some people in South Africa, because he'd won the previous years. And so the six of us were really well looked after for about, you know, 4 or 5 days before the race, and that, you know, shown around, and that. So that was really good. How I came about my interest in comrades and why I said yes to Malcolm was goes back a bit further. That's why I asked, because about your background with South Africa. But I think in 1988, a local guy I knew, and I knew he was an ex-South African, he gave me a tape of the Comrades Marathon where Fordyce had won, and against Mark Page, and Mark Page and Jetman Masutu are flying along out in front of the race, you know. And I think Page had about a 2 minute gap on Fordyce, you know, as he got to Polly Shorts. And then just as he started going up Polly Shorts, yeah, Page famously started cramping, and as soon as Page cramped, you look behind and you saw a vehicle, you know, in the background, and it was Fordyce. And Fordyce just comes, not jogging, but steadily up the road, and you know, passes Page, shakes his hand, and he goes in for, you know, one of his famous victories again. So I'd seen that that videotape, and that always had, I thought, oh, that's something that would interest me. So yeah, I was very keen when Malcolm, I would have gone in 93 if the invitation had come, you know, a bit sooner than, you know, it was most probably about 3 or 4 weeks before the race. And so in 94, yeah, we were looked after well, and we raced against, they nominated six South African runners, which included Nick Bester, Sean Mickeljohn. No, it wasn't Sean Mickeljohn. The guys that were running the World 100Ks, which were on the 26th of June, it was May 31 was the race day for his comrades. The guys running the 100Ks in Japan weren't allowed to race, and that included Mickeljohn because he came second in that race. It was Bester, Charles Matthays. I think, I'm not too sure. I'm going to say maybe not. Thompson Magwana.
Yeah, Tuition still holds the record.
I ran past Thompson at about Jesmond Road.
Yeah, that record's and, been long-standing.
Yeah, he's up to about my chest. So, I can't quite remember the other guys, but yeah, they ended up beating the international team that we're in. So, of the international guys, in that race, obviously Salazar won. It was a hot day. I didn't run particularly well. And I ran 5:59, and I showed that in 96 by running 10 minutes quicker, because unfortunately my iron levels were fairly low, and I hadn't figured that out until pretty late before the race, and I wasn't able to get my iron levels back up, and so I had a good aerobic engine, but I just didn't have any top speed. And when we got to the top of Fields Hill, I was in the big Fordyce bus on the day, and you know, Fordyce and these guys just peeled away from us at top of Fields Hill, and I thought, oh, you know, I'm just comfortable at the pace I'm going. I'm not going to pick it up, and I didn't, and went through halfway. It was probably in 2:50 something, 2:52, 2:53 or something like that, and then a bit after halfway, then I'm just going along nice and steady, and I was in about 60th place, I think, at halfway, and then I'm going along nice and steady, and then there's a guy up ahead of me, you know, and I've caught him, and then there's another guy up ahead of him, and I catch him, and I catch him, and I catch him, and then I'm coming down to Mushapini, and you can just see ahead, you know, and I see up the road there's two runners, and one of them is this blonde-haired guy in a Rand singlet, and it's Fordyce, you know, and I'm just outside the top 20 at that stage, and so I thought I'd be nice to pass Fordyce going up Polly Short. So, you know, as soon as I round the corner and up the hill, I go straight past Fordyce. And then, yeah, a very exciting run, you know, as you're coming in always to Peter Maritzburg, especially when it was at finish at Jan Smuts Stadiums. You know, Jesmond Road and is it Washington Road or anyway, along there, they're coming in there. Yeah, the crowds are really vocal and that just so much noise, just dinning noise, and run up the ramp into the stadium, and then I come across the line 12th place, and I thought, oh well, they're pretty happy with that. Of the internationals, obviously Salazar won, Nick Bester was second, and Theoretically third. I think fourth place was a Swiss guy called Peter Karmazin, and he was over 40 at the time, and then the Frenchman Denis Gack, the French national record holder at the time, he got a gold medal. He was seventh, Charlie Doyle might have been fourth, and Peter Karmazin fifth, but it ran about that time. So there was five guys, international guys, in the top 10, including Salazar, went out, and I was 12th. The two Russian guys both pulled the pin in the race, and Bill Monat, who was getting near the end of his career, I passed him about 20 k's out as well. So that inspired me, of course, to go back. So I went back in 96, and Robbie Meyer, a fellow mate from Pietermaritzburg. Robbie looked after me. We stayed up in Pietermaritzburg, and then I went down just the day before the race and stayed with his brother and got out to the start. And yeah, I was training pretty well. I wasn't training great in 96, but I was training fairly well, and I didn't have any iron problem. And I think my 94 race, I was most probably in better shape. I ended up in 94 doing some really good stuff after Comrades. I ran a 6:51 for 100 Ks 26 days later in Japan, you know, and that was just making sure I got to the finish. But you know, but then I backed up in 94 in early August. I won. I ran a 88 Ks in a 7 day stage race in Tasmania. So this is after running Comrades in May and 100 K in June. In early August, I turn up in Hobart, and we're running a 7 day stage race. I'm racing Kuros, I'm racing Charles Matthys from South Africa, Comrades winner in 95, and yeah, multiple gold medals. I'm racing against Santalov. I'm racing against another Russian called Krugolokov, a Hungarian guy who's a European 24-hour champion called Janis Bogar. Guy from Belgium who's the 100K champion, and some Pommies and a few other guys. So a really top class field, and I ran 88 Ks there in 5 hours 56. So that's equivalent to Comrades, but nowhere near as hilly, fortunately. So you know, and the following day we ran a 92 Ks, and I beat them again. You know, Kuros and Santalov, Kuros, the lot of them. You know. And the 99 Ks the next day, we're running at about, you know, a bit slower pace, but you know, 420, 430 a K the whole way. So I was in good shape in 94, and later on I defended the Australasian Championships against top line Russian guys and the Japanese record holder, and you know, I won that race. But 96, I 95, 96, 95 are in a couple of, I ran a marathon. I didn't go to Comrades. But I won a bit of money in that marathon, so I thought I'll go to Comrades with that prize money. So there in 96 for the next up run, and yeah, just it was much cooler day, but things had changed between 94 and 96. The goal pace moved 10 minutes. You know, before 96, you could have got a gold medal in Comrades for running on an up run, you know, 5:55, 5:56. Was in, as I got in the race, I'm running well, and I was running a fair bit away with Maria Back, was the German woman that won a couple of times, and her husband Kamazan Back, who was a Pole actually, but was running for Germany. I was running with Kamazan for most of the last half of the race. So not that we were running side by side. It was him in front, me in front, him in front, me in front. Very unfriendly guy, but I didn't mind. And you know, I was well off nowhere near the front, of course, but you know, we were moving along well, and everybody was moving along much better than 94. It was much better, cooler conditions. And I thought I lost Kamazan Back by the time I got to Polly Shorts. And just as I was probably about two thirds of the way up, this big German bull, you know, ran past me, and I was pretty surprised. And I thought, oh, you know, I get to the bit of the downhill, I'm just gonna just turn it over as hard as I can. And yeah, I turned it over as hard as I can, and I picked him up. And as soon as I went past him, I thought, yeah, you just don't look back, you know, just keep on focus. And once again, the dinning noise. We're finishing at Jan Smut Stadium, and I run in. I picked up a few places, maybe not as many as 94 from the top of Polly's to the stadium. I picked up a few places, and ran up the mound into Jan Smut Stadium and ran around on the grass. And as I'm coming around on the grass, the announcer goes, "End in 12th place, the Australian, Don Wallace." And I was sort of shattered after that to run 10 minutes quicker and still come 12th again. And 12th's one of those numbers that you know, I finished 12th in a few races. And the only thing I can say is 12th is better than 11th. much better than 11th, you know, in comrades especially. I'd hate to be a guy that ran 11th. And if I ran 11th twice, well, you'd say that's it, you know, you'd give up running forever, you know, because you just won one place off a gold medal. So being 12th wasn't as bad as it was, you know, like it wasn't too bad. So, but that just made me hungry, you know, so I just went back home again. The late 90s, I didn't do much running. I ran a marathon. Actually, I came back from the 96 and ran the Gold Coast Marathon in about 229, no, 226, I think. Yeah, 3 weeks after Comrades, I think it was. Was it or 5 weeks? 5 weeks after Comrades. Yeah, 5 weeks after Comrades. But after that, I'd had some, yeah, leg, ankle, heel issues, and I didn't run much in the late 90s, and yeah, but you know, the hunger was still there. And so at the end of 99, I decided, yeah, I better do something about this heel, and I had an operation just to fix that up, just a bit of shaving of the bone, and that sort of worked fairly well. And I started running well. I started training again late 99, early 2000, and I was getting fairly fit. And I thought, yeah, well, you know, this, my goal then was to get back to Comrades. And so the whole focus of early 2000 was Comrades. And I did some training that Barry McGee had talked to me about, which was really big mileage, just big, solid mileage, big, long, solid long runs. And when I say that with Comrades, it's not running. I didn't run any longer in my training. You know, it was 3 hour was my long run for the week. But I did plenty of 2 hour runs. You know, I'd be doing three 2 hours, three 1 hours and a 3 hour. That was my training. So it was 2 hours, 1 hour, 2 hours, 1 hour, 2 hours, sorry. Hour on Monday, 2 hours on Tuesday, hour on Wednesday, 2 hours on Thursday, hour on Friday, 3 hours on Saturday, 2 hours again on Sunday. And it's on my program. It's the program that Barry McGee used to give his marathoners. And you do that for 10 weeks and you get very, very big aerobic engine. And so I did that and got very fit, and I was feeling pretty confident, and turned up in 2000. My mate Robbie Myers, unfortunately, he'd passed away. He'd had a bad heart, and unfortunately passed away in between 96 and 2000. But his brother looked after me. His brother had run 17 Comrades, and I think he only had one kidney. So, you know, they're pretty tough over there in South Africa. And yeah, Kevin looked after me in Durban, and as we got out to the race, and yeah, that was just one of those days where you just run well and you feel good. And you know, I went through halfway very solid, and it probably was in the top 30 or something early on in the piece, 30 or 40, you know. But by the time I got to Olmos Road, I was in the top 10, or roundabouts there, you know. And yeah, and from then on, just pushed on. Didn't, you know, the last 12, 13 Ks, was probably didn't pass anyone, but you know, no one was past me. And I had no worries. I had all the confidence that once I get that late in the race, I'd learned from 94 that, you know, I'd be always strong later in the race. So, and that's where we finished at Scottsville Race Course, and that was very pleasing to run across the line there in eighth place and pick up a gold medal. So it's most probably, I don't know if your listeners know much about the Comrades Marathon, but the top 10 guys will get a gold medal. It's not just some plated piece of gold, it's 1 ounce of solid gold. So I think at the time it was worth 400 US. I think nowadays it's worth about 2000 US. And on that day in 2000, the winner, Kortov, he picked up 100 ounces of solid gold, a statue, for breaking the course record. 100 ounces of solid gold statue, but mind you, that's nothing compared with most probably the money that you get from your sponsorship deals and that when you win Comrades. So But for me as a runner, that's a pleasing sort of thing. Of any of the medals I get, that's, I don't know where they all are, but I certainly know where that gold medal is. And fortunately, in 2002, I went back and I got another eighth place. But once again, I sort of don't do things in halves. It's sort of, 12th twice and eighth twice. But 2002 was just a bit of luck, I think, on the day. I wasn't running particularly well. I was running all right, but I wasn't the hungry guy that I was in 2000, and or by that stage, 2002, I'm 41. So, I've had 16 years of hard running under my belt, which doesn't hurt, but some of it's going to break you down a bit. And it's just cruised through that race a bit, I suppose. And but just, you just keep going and pushing. And as I got to Mushipini that day, I was in 11th place running with one of the Liberty Nike runners, and I can sense that I was stronger than this guy running on the downhills, and that's a fairly good sign when you're running against the African guys. So I sort of left him just as we crossed the bridge at the bottom of Polly Shorts, and started going up the hill. And I come around the corner going up the hill, and then just in front of me is this big Russian guy. I think it was Oleg Kartanov, walking up the road. And I'm thinking, I'm in 11th place. He's in 10th place. Thank you very much. You don't get a medal walking up the hill. If you have to walk, you'd want to be just around the last few yards of the stadium, So yeah, I passed him, and fortunately then I picked up Andrew Clay and one other, well, maybe just Andrew Clay, yes, a couple of k's after the top of Polly's, and finished in eighth place, and at the Scottsville race course. So I think that was one of those ones where, the 12th, I was unlucky maybe for the 12s, but on that day, 2000, paid back with a bit of luck. So, a bit like roulette, some days you win, some days you don't.
That's it. You definitely left no stone unturned. I think one, I kind of want to pivot a little bit because I think I mentioned at the top in the intro is the course measuring side. And I'd love for you to take us behind the curtain as much as you possibly could. Where does it start? So are you involved in, like, do you give an opinion on the design elements, or is it very much like, hey, this is the course we want? Can you go out and measure and make it certified?
Most race directors, have a course, because it's a big process, especially with police and traffic management and road authorities nowadays, especially for the majors like Gold Coast and Sydney Marathon. I measure most of the quite a few of the marathons on the eastern coast here. So Brisbane, Sunshine Coast, Cairns. I've done Hobart Airport Marathon, so it's, the race organisers, they tee up their road and things like that. I mean, hopefully beforehand, I mean, some of the smaller people will send you something and they've got a bit of an idea and maybe you can help them out, but certainly the big ones, they're far more organised. And most of the ch courses don't change too much. So, but runners have got no idea really. As you're aware, Sydney's very big marathon now. Well, I started measuring that. So I'll go back to the start. I was interested in the idea of course measuring, and in 1990, Dave Cundy, who's a vice president of the Association of International Marathons, and also been an A grade course measure. He ran the Canberra Marathon for a long time. He was the main organizer of the Sydney Olympic Marathon. He was running a course for guys interested in course measuring in Brisbane, and I did it with half a dozen other guys. And one of the guys I work with, we work with a bit, he was organizing the Brisbane Marathon, and The other couple of guys who did the course most probably didn't do too much course measuring after that, but I just kept doing it, and yeah, people kept asking me to do stuff, so just kept, you know, it just kept going, and of course I'm here in Queensland. I got involved with the Gold Coast course. I've most probably been measuring that since the late 90s, and in 2002, I think there was a Sydney Marathon was run in 2001. I think Dave Cundy was involved with that a bit, but 2002, the people who were in 2001, nobody wanted to deal with them, and another mob took over, and that's when I got involved in Sydney, and later on, that the people who run the event is a company called Pont Three, but it's run by a guy who was a really good runner from New South Wales called Wayne Larden, and Larden Wayne ran 2:16 at the Gold Coast here 1 year, and he was a very good cross country runner. He's organised it, and he's made it into this big event now, which is becoming a candidate for the World Majors. So they needed a B grade measure, and at the time I was a B grade. You start off as a C grade measure, and if you do some measurements and put in some reports regularly, you know, after a couple of years, I'll make you B grade, and I become a B grade, so I could measure Gold Coast, and they needed a B grade measure in Sydney because they wanted a certain IAAF label. It's now World Athletics labeling, so I was able to do that. I am now an A grade course measure, and it's probably the highest course level I've measured. I measured the Commonwealth Games course at 18 at the Gold Coast, sorry, 2018 at the Gold Coast. So the organisers will organise a course on a big course like the Gold Coast of Sydney and things like, well, if you know the Sydney course, it runs across the Harbour Bridge. So, we measure by the shortest route that the runners will take across that bridge. We'll just shut down the bridge when we need to, and do a course measurement over that. They're the sort of guys I'm working with. The fellow I work with down in Sydney, he's just got he's got all the contacts with the Department of Main Roads and things like that. But just to give you an idea, in that 2002 race, I'm not exactly sure, but the figure I heard was that the cost from the Road Traffic Authority in New South Wales was $800,000. And I think the whole marathon event, the budget was over 2 million. That would pale into significant for what the budget for Sydney Marathon is now. I've got no idea what it is, but you're talking tens of millions of dollars. And runners don't get that. They just think, hey, you don't close down all the roads in a major city, or and it costs you nothing. It's very expensive. And unfortunately, of course, managing is a small, very, very small part of the cost. We'll need. I'm going to do some work in Sydney actually this weekend, and we'll need a police escort, and we'll need RTA guys or road, whoever, TMR, whatever they are down there, we'll need those guys out, and they'll all be paid, a special and things like that. And then when you close the roads, there's this massive amounts of barricading and contractors that are out there putting stuff out on the roads and that. But as far as measuring goes, we try, you try to ride around the whole course as much as you can. It's not very simple to. It's not that easy. Some think at the Gold Coast, I could almost go to the start and ride the whole course, almost, except you've got to go against the traffic coming back a lot across the bridge at Southport. Sydney is a little bit more complicated. I've got to cut it up into little bits and pieces and measure this bit, measure that bit, and just add it all up together. To give a quick thing of how a course is measured, we use what's called a calibrated Jones device on a bicycle wheel. A calibrated bicycle wheel has a Jones counter on it. So the counter sits on my front wheel, and as each wheel revolution occurs, the counter will be counted 22 times every revolution of the wheel. And so what we do is we'll calibrate that on a on a measured. So we'll measure a straight line with a steel tape of 300, 400 metres to an exact course. So we know that this is exactly on the road of at 300 metres. Nowadays, we used to use 500. We'll ride up and down that. We'll figure out how many counts are in 300 metres on the average after doing at least four times and averaging it out. And then we'll convert that into counts per kilometre. And then we add on 1 metre for every kilometre. So when we measure a kilometre, we measure 1,001 metres. So if I measure a 10K race, it'll be 10,010 metres. If I measure a half marathon, it'll be 21.0975 and 21 metres. And a marathon will be 42 metres long. Now, that's called a short course prevention factor, so that if another measurer came, if somebody set a record and another measurer came along, hopefully the course isn't short. Because if you had two guys, say I've measured a course with another A-grade measure once, and we'd still have a difference over the whole course, we might have a difference of 15 to 20 metres. So not too much, but there will be a slight difference. Not like a Garmin where you get a couple of guys run around the block together and they'll all have a different result. So that's how it's done. The guys that came up with this counter on the wheel was some American guys in the 70s, actually, and it was first used at the Montreal Olympics, and then it was adopted, and it's been used in the Olympics ever since. And then been used in all major marathons. And so if there's a course record, usually there'll have to be a remeasure of the course, a world best, as they call it nowadays. There'll have to be a remeasure of the course to check that that the course was accurate. Because as we know in the past, there was many instances of courses not being that accurate. And so every course measure follows the same procedure. And so yeah, there's some good accuracy between it, and you know, there's a fair bit of paperwork that's involved in it. I suppose that's one of the big things. It's not just going out there and riding the course and adding it all up. Then you know, I've got to develop reports and things like that, and race organisers will want, oh, where's the halfway mark, or where's the 5K things, and this and that. So all of this stuff needs to get sorted out. So there can be a fair bit of work to it. Yeah, if I'm working on the Sydney Marathon, I could be expecting, I think last year, maybe 6 or 7 days work went into that. So, yeah, it's not as simple as it
might look. It's not just getting your Google Maps out and tracing around with your finger.
Start, but yeah, it's a good start, but yeah, and when people do that, they always come up short. You know, when we measure on when we get down on the ground and measure, you know, it always ends up a little bit short. So you always need, the key thing with any race, and runners most probably don't like it, but if sooner or later you need some point where you run out, go around a turn and come back. And that's always there for adjusting. It's nice and simple at the Gold Coast because you run south, there's a turn point, you run north, there's a turn point. We always move the northern turn point. It's the one that we adjust on. And so it's adjusted late in the race. In Sydney Marathon, it's a little bit more trickier, but there is one which was in Moore Park Road, which is late in the race at the moment, but I think that'll change. But there'll always be one point where we've got to make a slight adjustment to get the correct distance. And the key thing for the race organisers is, you know, make sure you've got at least, you know, a couple of hundred metres there, because if you don't, it won't work. You know, if you've plotted it on Google something or other, or anything, or you know, online, it will be, a marathon could be 200 to 300 metres out.
Yeah, I think safest way to go, just plan to run further than the planned distance. You always hear it at the end of races, people going, oh, that was a long race, you know, they measured long, and it's actually, it's the way it's supposed to be. So
the garments, your watches are inherently incorrect. So they work on measuring where you are in, you know, pinpointing you in a circle on the ground, you know. And so as you move along, you know, depending on how it reads, you know, it could, read anywhere. The other thing is too is we take the shortest possible route. You know, so I'm riding a bike. You know, when we're measuring the Gold Coast, we do that in the evenings. So there's no traffic or anything like that. Though I've got following vehicles and things like that. And you know, if I've got to do a say a right turn and then a left turn, I'm just going diagonally between those two corners. But if you've got as if you're in the back of the pack and you've got hundreds of runners around you, you're going to be going much further than the distance I run than I've measured. The lead guys have got more chance of running that shortest line, but even then they tend to follow the camera bikes. So yeah, we but that's what we've got to do. We've got to measure the shortest route that somebody could take.
Yeah, nice. Well, thanks so much for giving us a quick peek behind that. I think hopefully people who go into their next marathons, once you're finished, you're finished. That's the official distance. And I think we look back at races and go, oh, that was a PB and this was a PB. But the courses are certified for a reason, and it's also why you pay a bit extra as well. Because they've gone to the effort of getting those races certified. But to finish, Don, the question I always ask a guest is, if you had a message to your younger self, what would it be?
Oh, yeah, but most probably some of the injuries I've had, I most probably like I said in it took me about 4 years in 90, although probably in the mid by about 94, 95, I think I was having problems with my heel, and I think one of the things I should have done was go and get an operation and fix up the problems with my heel. I didn't get the other one done till recently, you know, and it was giving me curry for years and years. But I don't think that's the most sensible thing. I suppose it's just looking after yourself. But most probably I don't think it's a message to your younger self, but as a runner, that this is the way I've always looked at it is, well, if you're going to do this, well, just put in your best effort, you know, get the right advice, take the right advice, and put in your best effort, you know. And there's a lot of guys I train with, you know, had that sort of attitude, and you know, we all got good results, you know, and lots of enjoyment from it, you know. It's not something for the faint-hearted if you want to. If you want to, you know, and runners know that, I think too, you know. Be prepared to put in a bit of work, and you'll get the reward. So, yeah, that's the key thing with running.
Cool. Well, thanks heaps, mate. Really appreciate
No
you
worries.
taking us back through your running history as well. And I think we pretty much just scratched the surface. But yeah, appreciate you jumping on, saying yes. I think plenty of names that people recognize there, and a lot of previous guests as well. So yeah, appreciate your time today.